Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A&E Network has set a November premiere for the Killing Season docuseries from Oscar-winning executive producer Alex Gibney, from Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. This 8-episode series follows documentarians Joshua Zeman, Cropsey, and Rachel Mills from Killer Legends as they investigate one of the most bizarre, unsolved serial killer cases of our time, the deaths of 10 sex workers discovered on Gilgo Beach, Long Island. Authorities believe these killings are the work of the Long Island serial killer, who after 5 years remains at large. Forging relationships with cyber sleuths, journalists, and victims' families, Zeman and Mills uncover connections that suggest Long Island is just the beginning. Through their investigation, the pair discover connections to unsolved murders from Atlantic City to Daytona Beach and beyond, revealing that serial killers are targeting sex workers in record numbers while using the Internet as their virtual hunting ground. The Killing Season will premiere with back-to-back episodes November 12th. The Killing Season, the A&E documentary series, premiering November 12th, with my special guest, documentarian filmmakers Joshua Zeman and Rachel Mills. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, and welcome to the program, Joshua Zeman and Rachel Mills.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is powerful. This is important, gripping, disturbing. Incredible. Congratulations. I give all the credit to this incredible investigation that you've undertaken and this project, The Killing Season. Now, Rachel, you were just a little briefly your background to show the audience basically where you came from before this project. You're a producer and assistant director, and you were known for Killer Legends just recently in 2014. And Josh Zeman, you were responsible for the Netflix Cropsey brilliant documentary in 2009, and you wrote and directed that. And you were both involved with Killer Legends, and you, as you say, investigated the origins of some of our most terrifying urban legends and true stories that may have inspired them. Now,
That's right. This,
The Killing Season, tell us, I guess maybe Rachel, tell us what was the genesis of The Killing Season? How did it come to be that both of you people decided to do this? Tell us what those circumstances were.
Sure. Well, we both live in New York, and this first case, the Gilgo murder investigation, was in Long Island, which is not such a jump, hop, and a skip away from where we are in New York. So the first set of bodies, four bodies found within days of each other back in 2010. So those bodies were discovered after a sex worker named Shannon Gilbert, a young woman, went missing back about a year before. So during her search, during the search for Shannon Gilbert, police stumbled upon these four sets of bodies along a desolate highway. Months after that, about six more bodies were found, not too far away. So a lot of carnage along one strip of highway out in Long Island. And with so many bodies, we thought that this case would be solved. But year one went by, year two went by, and it seemed to be no movement. So, you know, once about the third year went by, Josh and I were doing Killer Legends, and we decided, well, you know what, this should be our next project. And we were going to do this as a documentary feature, But after investigating the Gilgo case, discovered that, unfortunately, crimes such as these involving sex workers are happening all across the country, and there seems to be not a lot of answers very similar to that being the case in Long Island.
Now, Josh, you started, as you say, in this, that you started this investigation on Memorial Day.
Yeah.
With that investigation, how did you begin your investigation on Memorial Day into the Long Island serial killing case?
Well, I mean, one of the first things we were doing was, you know, interviewing sex workers. And I, there's a woman that you see in the series named Super, and we were driving around with her, and it was just so fascinating because here was a woman who was escorting in the same, you know, kind of hunting grounds that the killer was using, and she didn't know that much about the case. I mean, she knew women had been killed, and, you know, we were driving her around, taking her from hotel to hotel, talking to her about, you know, sex work and was she afraid. And what she didn't know is that Memorial Day was basically the start of the hunting season for this killer. It's believed that he found most of his victims during that time. And so one of the reasons that she didn't know this is because the police weren't really telling anything to anybody. You know, it was unfathomable to me that with so many murders out there that the police at some point stopped talking to the general public, stopped communicating to the general public. And, you know, when that happens, people are going to speculate. And, you know, that was one of the reasons that we decided to pick up a camera.
Now let's go back to the story that you capture so, I mean, vividly and disturbingly and grippingly. Let's go back to Shannon Gilbert. And as you talked about, you had access to this woman called Super, and you, at some point in this documentary, go on a, you drive a prostitute around for a week. So you really do see, get a little slice of life from their own lens. So tell us about, the Shannon Gilbert and her real state of affairs. How long had she been a prostitute? What was her background just before this? Tell us the case of, or the story of Shannon Gilbert to reveal how they discovered the other bodies on Gilgo Beach.
Well, that's one of the weird things here. You know, basically Shannon Gilbert is an escort. She's living in Jersey City, and she gets a call from a prospective John out in this kind of very desolate area known as Oak Beach. And she has a driver, which is kind of interesting because, you know, a driver is not like a pimp. It's just someone who's driving her out to where she's going. And she goes, she meets a John by the name of Joseph Brewer. They, you know, party for a couple hours, and then something happens. We don't quite know exactly what it is, but Brewer's been very open with police, and he says that Shannon starts to freak out. Something must have happened, something must have spooked her, and he calls the driver who's waiting outside. The driver comes in, a man by the name of Michael Pack. They try and bring Shannon kind of back to the car to get her out, and she's like hiding behind the couch. She's so freaked out. At some point, Brewer reaches for her, you know, to kind of pull her outside of his house, and she freaks out. She runs outside. She apparently trips and falls, gets back up, and then she starts to run through this kind of seaside community. By the way, it's very isolated. It's about 20, 25 minutes away from any store or anything like that, and she's knocking on neighbors' doors, screaming for help. She knocks on a couple neighbors' doors. Some answer, some don't. One of them, a guy by the name of Gus, kind of invites her to her inside. This is about 5 o'clock in the morning. And she is screaming that they're trying to kill her. She's hysterical. and he says he's going to call the police. She says, no, don't call the police. She runs back down the stairs and kind of runs to this community. Meanwhile, Michael Pack, who's her driver, is searching for her. And to make a long story short, she basically runs down the street towards the water and is never seen from again. And it's at this point that kind of the real mystery begins. The police eventually come a couple hours later, and at that point, Shannon had made a phone call to 911 on her cell phone. And Shannon didn't really know where she was. So she said she was near Jones Beach. So she is routed to the state police. In fact, Shannon is not really in Jones Beach anymore. She's in a different area. She's actually just right across the county line. So the call gets transferred to Jones Beach, and then it gets transferred to another law enforcement agency on the Suffolk County side. And basically she's on the phone for, like, I think 21 to 23 minutes, kind of screaming for help and all these other things, and then her phone goes dead. And so she could never tell the police when she was on the phone where she was. And the only reason the police came was because the neighbors who had called her. And so there's a little bit of a, you know, disconnect there between Shannon's 911 call and then the neighbors' 911 calls. And in fact, that connection is never made. The two law enforcement agencies never sync up. And what basically happens is the driver goes home. He doesn't know what happens to her. And then Shannon's boyfriend calls the driver when she doesn't come home. And then they try and file a missing persons report. We hear that, or we're told basically when the boyfriend and the John go to file a missing persons report in Suffolk County, there's some, they kind of laugh, you know, because sex workers, you know, she's a sex worker, you know, she probably just ran out is what they said. And there's a definitely fumbling of the missing persons case. Shannon, as I mentioned before, was from Jersey City. So, you know, there's some unknown idea of where the missing persons report should be filed, Jersey City where she's from or Suffolk County where she disappears from. And Shannon's missing persons report, neither law enforcement agency really wants to kind of take the missing persons report. So there's all these factors that lead up to the fact that no one is kind of looking for Shannon for a couple days. Now, the crazy thing is, Shannon, no one can find her, and it basically takes more than a year for that to happen. So while the police, you know, they spend a couple days, even weeks looking for her, they can't find her. Nobody knows what happens. But meanwhile, one of the cadaver dogs and the trainer who had been searching for Shannon basically had been using that same area a couple months later to train his dog, and the dog stumbles upon the bodies of four other escorts, sex workers, who had been found wrapped in burlap about a mile and a half away from where Shannon disappeared. And that kind of jumpstarts the whole story.
Now, Rachel, just the part that in the documentary that you and Josh do is to talk to somebody, the police, and get their opinion on Shannon Gilbert and the likelihood of this being an accident, and that's what they chalked it up to. But you also talk, again, have incredible access to people in the family. So tell us the difference between those two interviews of their opinions on what happened to Shannon.
Sure. Well, just to be transparent, we did not talk to any active police in the first few episodes. That you'll see probably changes later on, but we talked to Dormer, who is the ex-police commissioner of Suffolk County, and he does believe that Shannon's death was an accident, that she simply drowned in the marsh and expired. Now, the thing is that the police have been pretty tight-lipped. The family would probably argue that they haven't heard from the police for quite a while, and when you don't hear from police, you know, it creates a void of information, and therein creates a lot of speculation. And also, you know, this is the family members who have not a lot of answers, you know. The 23-minute 911 call has not been released, and I understand their argument that if the police are saying it is an accident, then why wouldn't they release a 23-minute 911 call? There doesn't seem to be a lot of reason that if they do agree that it is an accident, why they wouldn't release that. So the family is simply looking for answers, and they do believe that there was some kind of foul play with Shannon's death. Now, you know, Josh and I are on the side that, you know, she probably did expire in that marsh. However, that doesn't mean she didn't meet someone during her 23-minute journey running up and down the dark streets of Oak Beach. You know, we don't know if someone gave her something that, you know, combined with maybe another drug she took that led her to go into that marsh. And that marsh is very, very cold. You know, Long Island, I mean, it's a small stretch of land between a bay and an ocean. The winds are very strong, even in the beginning of May, which is when she died in that marsh. Josh and I went out there, and I was freezing, you know, and I had gloves, I had galoshes on, and, you know, she supposedly stripped bare and went through it. So it doesn't surprise me that the elements can get you when you get into that marsh. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions in the Shannon Gilbert case. And again, if they do really believe that it is totally accidental and she did drown, just release the 23-minute phone call so we can move on and investigate the rest of these murders. Because when we talk about Shannon Gilbert, the attention goes to her, which is understandable, but there's also another, you know, 9 bodies, 5 of which are unidentified, which could lead to a lot of answers in the Kyogo investigation.
Now, what you do is you introduce, I guess, to the world, the people, the rest of the world that doesn't know about websleuths.com. And you also introduce a character, you say an amateur profiler that you vetted through a pretty interesting process to be able to believe that what he is saying is credible, and this is a Peter Brent. So tell us about Web Sleuths and the rise of this crowd-solving community, and also what Peter had said initially about Shannon Gilbert and in relation to the Long Island serial killer. And what he had, and his thoughts about the Long Island serial killer.
I mean, this goes back to the idea that, you know, after 3 years, the police, you know, stopped talking to the public. And, you know, I guess they stopped talking because, you know, they really didn't have any answers. And as a result, as we were saying, when you stop speaking to the public, you start to get a lot of speculation. And especially in, you know, in this kind of digital age that we're living in. And so there was an explosion of speculation on the Internet. Now, what's very interesting is that a lot of this speculation was in a lot of different forms. People were trolling each other, sniping each other, calling each other the killer, the whole nine yards. That's in a very unorganized way. But, you know, the Internet, you know, when it comes to true crime, what we've noticed is there's been this real rise in the Internet sleuthing. And one of the places that's very good about Internet sleuthing is a site called Web Sleuths. And, you know, this explosion of kind of looking at theories and clues really started in the JonBenet Ramsey case. But, you know, it also, like, took on a life of its own in the List case because there was so much speculation. So, because the police weren't saying anything, we went to Web Sleuths. We wanted to hear what people were saying. And on Web Sleuths, we met this guy, Peter Brent. And, you know, everybody says there's a lot of kind of crazy crackpots on Web Sleuths. And, you know, we definitely saw that. But we could also tell that there were other people who seemed to know what they were talking about. One of them was Peter. And I remember we kind of called him up and he, right off the bat, you know, he seemed to know exactly what he was talking about. And I remember I even gave him some of the case files from Cropsey to see if he knew what he was talking about, and he did. And one of Peter's initial things that he gave us was saying, you know, hey, listen, you know, I don't believe Shannon is connected. And he gave some really interesting reasons, and he also kind of said, you know, it's the problem is the Suffolk County Police. You know, they botched the case. And so we started to really connect with Peter, and what he was saying was very interesting. A lot of things that I didn't know at the time, like, for example, the behavioral profiling unit that was made famous in The Silence of the Lambs, like, that agency has been gutted. All those profilers have been taken over and are now working on counterterrorism. So kind of no one is left to really look at serial killers anymore. And so he just opened up this whole fascinating world to us, whether it's the amount of serial killers who are really out there or the fact that, you know, he believes, and people now say, I had no idea, that in New York City alone, there are 6 active serial killers at any one time. And that was just shocking to me.
Another statistic that is very important to this story, and I think will be very important to the future of being able to profile these killers and addressing this problem even remotely, and that is that you cite a statistic about how many serial killers, or how many, the percentage of prostitutes that were killed at one time as opposed to the percentage of prostitutes are killed by serial killers today, and why.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a statistic I didn't know either, but makes a lot of sense when you start thinking about it. I think from the 1970s, we learned that serial murder involving sex workers increased by, I believe it's 70%. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, serial killers were going after runaways, sorority girls, hitchhikers, you know, but in this trackable society that we live in now, they know, the killers know who to go after. And those are the people who are living on the fringes. Those are the people who are trying to evade law enforcement themselves. Those are the people who are using burner cell phones, who are dealing in cash transactions, who are posting to Backpage and Craigslist. You know, we think that everyone, you know, can be connected by an IP address or a phone number, or obviously they can track something. But, you know, these women are smart, and they want to continue doing business in the way that they are. And to do that, they need to be not trackable. And these serial killers know that. They know that, for one, just technologically they're not trackable. In addition, these women are living on the fringes and do move around a lot and do go underground, and in some cases are being controlled by pimps themselves. And so they know that. And they know also that, you know, sometimes a lot of police agencies don't take their missing persons cases seriously. In addition to, if a sex worker comes up dead, may not have that at the top of their priority because they're not blonde hair, blue eyed sorority girls, and they don't have a community banging down on their doors to solve a case, which is completely tragic. So yeah, that's a statistic I did not know, and it is very sad.
Let's get back to Gilgo Beach, and we just touched on how the 4 bodies were buried and arranged. You discussed, Josh, with Peter about the significance of how they were buried, we'll say, for example, and the burlap.
Right.
And so before we get into the other bodies that are found later, let's talk about those 4 bodies and what you and Peter discussed and what your conclusion was in the film, at least, about the Long Island serial killer and those 4 bodies.
Yeah, I mean, look, those 4 bodies, they're known as the Gilgo Beach 4, and that's because the signature is pretty much the same. Sex worker, kind of around the same, you know, height and size, all wrapped in burlap. All they were skeletonized, but they weren't dismembered, and they were kind of dumped in the brush about 500 feet from each other in this kind of very specific section. So that's kind of very much one signature. And, you know, as Peter was telling us, you know, this is very much collection behavior. You know, this guy likes to probably drive along the highway knowing that, you know, he's buried these bodies there. You know, a lot of returning to the scene of the crime. Maybe he stops, maybe he doesn't. But, you know, these women, because their signature is so specific, because of the graveyard staging, because of how the bodies were wrapped in burlap, they get one signature, and they're known as the Gilgo Beach Four.
So now tell us the circumstances of the investigation, how, again, we already know that this investigation is stymied, obviously.
Yep.
But give us the circumstances in which other bodies are discovered.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, after the four were found in December of 2010, over the next 4 months, I believe it was another five bodies were found that continue to be unidentified. That includes a mother and child, a mother and toddler, an Asian male who was found in women's clothing, another woman whose body parts were found years before, actually two women whose body parts were found years before, and then another set of their body parts were found during those months. So you still have five unidentified remains, which is huge, in my opinion, to be a source of clues to possibly solve an investigation. I think that's actually one of the biggest ways that you could solve this case, is to identify one of those unidentified people. And, you know, we talk about web sleuths, and we worked with a gentleman on web sleuths whose name is Carl Kay, who's had, I think, about five or six matches of linking up missing persons with unidentified remains. And that is one of the best things web sleuths is good at. So, you know, we know there is information that the police have that they have not yet released, and I hope that they do, and maybe they will after the show airs. For instance, they have clothing from Asian male. He was dressed in women's clothing. They could release a photo of that dress. Someone might have seen that person. We think that he was a sex worker, so you have an Asian male sex worker in women's clothing. We also know that he had a limp. So that's a lot. That's actually, it doesn't sound like much maybe, but that's a lot to go on. So if they simply, you know, release that information, that could be a huge clue. In addition to that, the mother and toddler who were thrown 7 miles away from each other, and which I think that pretty much the killer did know what he was doing to separate those bodies. But the toddler was wrapped in a blanket, you know, another fabric that they have. And it's a child. There's family members out there who I'm sure know this child is missing. So as far as status on these additional bodies, there's a wealth of information out there, and it's, hopefully it'll just take time for the case to unfortunately go even more cold, to where the police will feel compelled to finally reach out to the public with information they've held back for so long.
And can I say something else about these bodies? So, you know, we were talking before about the Gilgo Beach Four. These bodies, interestingly enough, have a completely different signature. These bodies were not wrapped in burlap, and for the most part, they were dismembered. Also, you know, they were dismembered. The body parts that we're seeing here, they're pretty much identification body parts, hands, forearms, head, things like that. Now, Rachel had mentioned that there were six bodies, and it's very interesting. One of those bodies, a woman who is known as Fire Island Jane Doe. Now, what's interesting about her, part of her body parts were found along this stretch of road called Ocean Parkway. But her severed legs were actually found on another barrier island just north of Gilgo Beach called Fire Island. And those legs were discovered in 1996. Now, that's where you start to bring in these questions if you're a forensics guy, saying, huh, 1996, and the GB4, these four women were found in 2010. Wow, that's quite a long time for a single killer to be active. Now, there's something else that you should start to question here. Two of these same dismembered body parts, the other half, let's say, of these two women, one is known as Jane Doe number 6, and the other one, whose name we do know, Jessica Taylor, their other halves, their torsos pretty much, were found in Manorville. Now, Manorville is another desolate area, but this is like the woods. This is called the Pine Barrens of Long Island. And they were found over 40 miles away. So you start to get confused. I mean, look at all the different body parts we're talking about. Look at the different signatures that we're talking about. We've got women who are found, half their body parts are found here, half their body parts are found 40 miles away. You've got another woman whose legs are found in 1996, it starts to bring up a lot of questions about different signatures and length of time and what is really going on here. And this basically gets to one of the core questions of this case, which is, how many serial killers are we really talking about here? And I remember when we first heard about this case and somebody started whispering that it may not just be one serial killer, but it's in fact two. I thought that was somebody was making it up. It sounded to me like a movie. But after looking at this case, and it's extremely complicated, if I've confused you, that is what the killers have obviously intended to happen. And I now do believe, in fact, that it is two killers, which goes against the former commissioner Richard Dormer's theory, but some other police, including the current district attorney, do believe it's two killers. And to me, the fact in this day and age, we can have all these different body parts and we know so much through CSI and forensics, yet for there to be such question among experts is really shocking to me.
What's fascinating is that you take it to the web sleuths and Peter. And what does Peter deduce about the two? He agrees with you about two serial killers, but what does he say? It's very dramatic and very interesting.
Well, I mean, Peter's German, right? So he has a great style of saying things, and like we say, he's very good for TV. He goes, "You're not dancing with one serial killer; you're dancing with two." But what Peter says, and what I found the most fascinating, is that when you hear about two serial killers operating in the same area, you usually think they're working together. But what he says is, in fact, they're in competition. And he believes we're dealing with two different serial killers. One, the Lisk killer, known as the Long Island serial killer, who's killed the GB4. And then we have this other serial killer, known as the Manorville Butcher. And this guy, this Manorville Butcher, he calls him a torso killer. Now, Peter, a lot of what Peter says, trust me, we go in and we do a lot of background check. Like, is Peter really right? Is he, we didn't know during the whole show whether he was, kind of taking us for a ride. And torso killers are really a special, special breed. They come up a little bit in history. There's the Cleveland torso killer, which is a very interesting case for everybody who's kind of into that stuff. There's some believe the Black Dahlia killer is related to torso killing. And then there is probably one of the most famous torso killers of all time, which is the Whitehall Chapel murderer. And again, this goes back to the idea of torso killers are very competitive, and that may be actually what happened in the Jack the Ripper case. You had Jack the Ripper, and then you had the Whitehall Chapel murders.
Interesting. Now let's get to one of the most profound parts of this The entire series is profound, but early on, you have an interview with Melissa Bartholomew. I probably mispronounced the name, and then the sister. So tell us her story and this frightening phone call that they get years later. Tell us her story.
Yeah, Melissa went missing, if I'm not mistaken, which I definitely could be, in 2009. And she went missing from Manhattan. Supposedly, she had gotten a $1,000 out call and was headed to Long Island. That's about all that we know. Fast forward, I believe it was only a few days. Is that right, Josh?
I don't think it was a few days.
I think it might have been a few weeks.
Yeah.
And her sister Amanda, her sister Amanda was actually supposed to go see her only a couple of days after she went missing. So they knew something was wrong very early. They continued to try to call her, no answer. And then all of a sudden they received this phone call from Melissa's phone. It came up on caller ID as Melissa. So, of course, they're, relieved that Melissa's okay and calling. But Amanda answers the phone, and it's a guy on the other end of the line. And he tells Amanda, who's very young at this point, I believe she's only about 15 years old, and very close with her sister, told her that, he has Melissa, and that, I don't remember the specifics right now, but over the course of the next few weeks, he continued to call her and torment her with what he was doing with Melissa at the time, with the last phone call saying that he had killed his sister, her sister, and maybe one day he'll go and show her where she's buried. That's the biggest clue right now that I think we know exists, that of the killer. I don't think this is a prank phone call at all. I think this was really the killer who called her. Unfortunately, this is back 6 years ago. Technology wasn't as great as it is now. It's unknown whether they were able to really trace the call. If they were, when they traced it, it was traced to Midtown near the Long Island Railroad near Penn Station. So there's speculation whether that guy was a commuter who lived in Long Island. Did he just go there because he knew that a lot of other people, it's a big tourist attraction, would be there. So even if they did trace the call, they couldn't pinpoint it to him. But it's really interesting, and it's really tragic and sad that, she's the only person we know who's actually spoken to him. It's sick and it's twisted that he continued not only to torment Melissa, but got his rocks off in tormenting the family as well.
Yeah, I mean, what we do know from killers, what we do know from an expert on, I think it's post-murder communication. Rach, what's his name? Do you remember that gentleman's name? He was awesome.
Dirk Gibson.
Oh, yeah, that's right, who's wrote numerous articles on, this idea of the communication that happened after. And, this can be very similar to, the kind of either the Jimmy Breslin, Son of Sam communications, although that's actually in reality quite different, or the Zodiac, which this is probably more of. But, it's a way for these killers to continue to kind of relive the fantasy, basically that same killing by kind of tormenting the sister. I mean, he said, I hear you're a half-breed, do you know what your sister did, indicating the fact that, some judgment on the fact that she was a sex worker. So it's really tragic what happened, but we do believe, in fact, that is the biggest mistake that the killer has made to date.
You also, I want to elaborate just a bit, because you do have, in the book, or pardon me, in the series, that you talk about that he called and he said to Amanda, who was 14 or 15, "Are you a whore like your sister?" And that was very important. The word and the language that he used in that call. And then you also spoke to Peter as well. You discussed with Peter as well the significance of this, again, this communication. And also he mentions at the end that he said, listen, I've killed your sister. I've finally killed your sister. I'm going to watch her body rot. And maybe someday I'll come and get you to go come and see. And so it's very powerful when you have the father explaining that, and then you have the sister just in silhouette explaining her story. Very, very powerful. But what does Peter believe about that communication from the Long Island Ceiling Killer in terms of significance, in terms of evidentiary value, that being the first verse contact?
I don't know, Rich, what does he say about that? I forget.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we talk about like trying to figure out where he went wrong. Like, where can we find his so Peter says with Maureen Brainerd Barnes, who arguably his first victim, you know, go back to her. Because you'll see him in his forming stages and see where he may have tripped up. Now, do you want to give this away, Josh?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Now, Sarah Carnes, who was with Maureen Brainerd Barnes the night she went missing, and she's the first of the Go-Go Beach Four to go missing back in 2007, her friend Sarah was with her that night, last person to see her. Sarah says 2 weeks to the day, she received a call, and she does believe the person who called her, who said, are you friends with Marie? Marie was Maureen's street name, her call girl name, and she said, you know, she's fine. She's in a whorehouse in Queens, so you brought up the word whore. You know, if that was him, which Sarah Carnes is convinced it was him, he's using the word whore, which a lot of people don't use. And so, you know, that could have been a mistake early on that he made. So, you know, if he's still active, he could have moved on. He could be in prison. He could be dead. He could be in a latent period in his killing, but he sounds like he is a person who does really enjoy the communication factor, enjoy continuing that tormenting of people who are close to these victims. So if that is true, and he has continued doing what he's doing, it wouldn't surprise me if he does continue killing, that he will communicate with those close to the people he has killed.
Yeah.
Now, Josh, tell us about the further involvement with Web Sleuths and how they uncover an actual name from the Suffolk County Police Department.
Right.
So this is very exciting.
Well, you know, that wasn't a Web Sleuther, but that was actually one of our associate producers. But she, much like the Web Sleuth, kind of trolls the internet looking for information. And, you know, as she says, I had no idea about this, that Wikipedia is community, you know, sourced. And you can go in on Wikipedia. And what she wanted to do is she just wanted to see what people were doing in terms of, like, vandalizing the LISC Wikipedia page. And she finds in the history somebody had put a proper name, a gentleman's name. And we kind of pull up the gentleman's name, and we see that he is currently he's been charged, theoretically, he's a corrections officer, and he's been charged with harassing some women in the Suffolk County prison. And we, you know, that's interesting for sure, but of course it could be trolling. I mean, there's so much trolling. But the most interesting thing was the person who posted the information seems to have posted from inside the Suffolk County Police Department, because that's where the IP address was from. And so that raises a whole bunch of questions. Is it somebody who believes that this guy did it and somehow you know, they don't have the evidence? Is it an example of trolling? I mean, just the idea that somebody from inside the Suffolk County Police Department or somebody using that IP address posts a name to Wikipedia suddenly calls into a whole bunch of questions. Is it the guy or, you know, what kind of control is happening at Suffolk County Police Department? Is that just, you know, trolling from inside? I mean, so we ended up looking at that guy, and that was very interesting. Kind of, I think we did an interesting job of, you know, kind of sourcing whether he was involved or not. But I think this is the idea. This is, it's kind of like a perfect example of how you can use the internet in the proper way to kind of theoretically dig up clues.
Yeah, the thing is that this is an incredible, while he, this Long Island serial killer, and then as you talk about in the series, that it goes way beyond this just one investigation, and we will talk about a little bit of the linkage that you do make. But what I wanted to say was the incredible step-by-step hunt that you have for this Long Island serial killer and the, I guess, better term, a sort of a gumshoe approach to tracking down information, speaking with victims' families, anybody that could speak to you. Every telephone call is recorded. So it just seemed to be like little bits, little piece by piece, very much like a police investigation. Your investigation is going where the police don't either have the time, focus, or, as you point out in the series, how unconnected police forces are. And while we're talking about that non-connectedness, you do talk about VICAP and its failings. So tell us about what you did find out about VICAP, what we think we believe about VICAP, and what is reality.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was, in hindsight, I was really naive coming into this series, at least when it concerns law enforcement agencies being connected. You know, I think that we all have this preconceived notion that there's some big brother data cloud where we're feeding data into 24/7. And that's really not the case. I really thought that, you know, there's a missing persons database, an unidentified remains database, a homicide database, and they were all interconnected and cross-referenced, and if someone goes missing in Kansas and they pop up in Illinois, you know, I'm simplifying it, that a yellow light would go off and, you know, the case would be solved. That's absolutely not the case. You know, we live in a very, very fractured system. It's a broken system. You know, I did not know that law enforcement agencies do not have to report their homicide data. They are not mandated to report their homicide data into any kind of federal database, and that database would be VICAP. So there are so many dots that cannot be connected because of that. You know, and further on in the series, we become acquainted with Tom Hargrove, who's a data journalist, he's a citizen. He has compiled the largest homicide database in the country by going through Freedom of Information Acts and in some cases suing the state of Illinois for their homicide data. So we have a long way to go to the place where I think a lot of people think we exist, which is like this, it kind of goes into that like CSI effect that with our what we think is so far futuristic technology that we should be able to solve all crimes. That's really just not the case. And I'm hoping that people will watch the show and realize that it's, yes, these cases are really horrific and tragic, and it's really sad for the families and the victims, and that these cases are unsolved. But in addition to that, that there are reasons why these cases remain unsolved, and that is because of this kind of linkage blindness, because of these connections that cannot be made. In addition to so many other societal factors, you know, we're creating a virtual petri dish for these killers to get away with murder.
Right. And just to add on to that, I mean, look, you know, we're not here to throw law enforcement under the bus. I think a lot of law enforcement understand the limitations of their own computer databases, you know, and a lot of enforcement law enforcement agencies do send their information in. But a lot of times information doesn't get sent in for whatever reason. And that really prevents even the best detectives from doing their jobs to the fullest extent. As you see in our show, you know, we had one of the former heads of ICAP tell us, like, they are missing connections, you know, thousands of missing persons, unidentified bodies. You know, if these systems were better, you know, if all this information was mandated and sent in, then we can do a much better job of connecting these crimes. And look, it can happen. In Canada, they have the VICAP system as well. It's slightly different, but basically it's based on our system. And all the law enforcement agencies in Canada have to send their murder data in. In America, we're dealing with 17 to 20,000 different law enforcement agencies. There's a lot of jurisdictional issues. And, you know, there's the perception that, you know, it's a freedom, you know, it's an individual freedoms issue. But we're talking about murder here. And so I don't think we should be dealing with, you know, personal liberty issues when we're talking about solving murders. And so it was just shocking to me. Again, not one single law enforcement agency in the United States is federally mandated to share its murder data with the FBI's VICAP system. It's just crazy to me. And all the time and effort and TV shows that just deal with solving cases and murders all day long, yet we don't even do that in real life. How does the world not know that?
Now, this incredible series has some stuff in other episodes that people will see November 12th in the two episodes that debut. But how does this investigation into the Long Island serial killer that we already have been talking about, that it looks like two serial killers with different signatures operating in the same area, if not more? You said six. Let's talk about how this investigation morphed into a much bigger investigation and included other cities like Daytona Beach and Atlantic City, and talk more a little bit about, which I thought was one of the most shocking things, is the statistics surrounding long-haul truckers and that type of long-haul serial murder.
Well, just before we get into that, I just want to clarify. I don't think we're talking about more than two serial killers. What we're saying is, like, in any big city with numbers like New York City, we're saying there could be six active serial killers at any one time. But just to be clear, I think in Long Island we're pretty specifically saying it's probably two, but probably not more. However, there are more serial killers, obviously, in Long Island. But I think with regards to the Gilgo Beach case, I think we're talking about a max of two. Some may disagree.
No, that's great. I mean, you did say New York, six, and Long Island, we've established two's enough, I think. So right now, anyway, back to this.
Rachel, how does the investigation
morph into those other cities?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it was not too far of a reach to go and investigate the AC murders, which was four sex workers found behind a CD hotel in a graveyard staging close to water, extremely similar to the case in Long Island with the Gilgo Beach Four. And that case broke in November of 2006, which was only about, 7-8 months before Maureen Brainerd Barnes disappeared, which was the first of the Gilgo Beach Four. So, you know, AC is only 120 miles away from Long Island, from Gilgo Beach. And so that was definitely worth us checking out. And we did. And yes, there are definitely eerie similarities. I would not say the same perpetrator is responsible, But what it led to was really discovering, and that's the point when I found out from Tina Clinette, who has done tons of research kind of on the progression of serial homicides involving sex workers, that they have increased by 70% since the 70s. So this whole kind of world opened up to us that I think we did not know necessarily existed, that serial killers were preying upon sex workers in record numbers all across America. You know, we started this series out looking at the Long Island case and looking at serial murder in general, thinking that, you know, we'd investigate different serial murder of not just sex workers, but of different populations. And it just kept coming up that these serial murder cases almost always involve not only people who live on the fringes, but sex workers and people who have substance abuse issues. So I think that once we investigated AC and we looked down that dark alleyway, that dark road, and with our communication with Web Sleuth, who told us, you know what, there's this case in Daytona, which is quite similar. You know, another four sex workers who were killed. It's a beach community. It's a tourist town near water. Kind of just kept going where the story led us. And you bring up long-haul truckers. That is a terrifying subset of killers. You know, not only do serial murderers know all the different contributing factors to having them being able to get away with murder, but long-haul truckers also understand that there is territorialism when it comes to crime. They understand that they can pick up a woman in one state, kill her, and dump her body in another state, and there's going to be jurisdictional issues. There's going to be a lack of connection for that. So, you know, it became bigger and bigger and bigger, and the wind just became wider and wider and wider as we continued looking into these cases.
You know, that was one of the things, you know, people ask us, you know, are these cases really connected? And we like to say they are, just not in the ways that you might think. And that's kind of one of the big overarching themes of the show. You know, look, a lot of your guests and deal with serial murder. You know, we're very into it as a society, serial murder. It's one of the most taboo subjects, and it's one of the most interesting to kind of figure out. Why does somebody do what they do, you know, and that whole thing, you know, profiling, etc. And, you know, I like it too. But sometimes we create connections to alleviate our fear. You know, it's a natural tendency to create connections. It helps us survive. And unfortunately, when we kind of create these connections, everybody had the last name or everybody was killed on the same date or all these other issues, we tend to kind of miss the big picture. And the connections here is not that it's one super-duper serial killer going through all these different, you know, beachside communities and killing these women. The connection is that we've created a culture that allows these women to be killed, and it allows these killers to believe that they can get away with it. And that is really the true message of what we're talking about. You know, as you said, you know, serial killing against sex workers has gone up dramatically. But there's a whole bunch of other issues at hand. The fact, as Rachel said, there's databases that aren't speaking to each other. And there's long-haul killers that know that with so many different law enforcement agencies that, believe it or not, that same old kind of Hollywood trope of territorialism, that's real. You know, they know that the best way to get away with murder is to dump a body over state lines. And you would think, well, that might have been – that probably worked in the 70s, but it's still true today. And that's what's so shocking.
Now, what did you talk about in the series as well is that once upon a time, if it wasn't risky enough for a woman just to jump into somebody's vehicle for drugs or for sex, without any kind of backup whatsoever, and those were the victims of serial killers, is that now, as you talk about in the series, that people feel that because it's social media or because it has some kind of legitimacy by being on the Internet, that they feel safer. And then you point out, again, the phenomena that I hadn't really thought about very much at all, the very, very horrifying subset, as you say, of serial murder with the long-haul truckers. And to add to the horror in the series, you interview a serial killer, John Robert Williams.
Just
tell us a little bit. Don't give it away, but, I mean, just tell us on how you got this interview and what you wanted to get, information that you wanted to get from John Robert Williams.
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, we wanted to find a killer who was in prison who would admit to his murders. That's very hard to do. I mean, a lot of these, mostly men, are, you know, going through trying to get new trials, get things overturned. So they're always looking for you to help them in that. I think that both Josh and I knew that I'd have better luck. You're mostly men, right? We would have better luck for me writing these letters, which is quite scary when I think about it. But so he was one of the few who wrote back and said, yes, I committed these murders. I actually killed up to 30 women. He may be embellishing, I'm not quite sure. And I would talk to you. And what we heard from him was actually spot on, quite surprisingly. And he said all the things that we had been talking about that he really understood as a long-haul trucker, that he could pick up a woman in one state and kill her and throw her in another state, because he said, and I believe he said, he has certain rules when it comes to killing, and one is, what was it, Josh? Don't kill.
Don't kill in your own hometown, you know. Drop the body, never, you know, and drop the body over state lines, and he said that that's how he got caught, you know.
Exactly. So we were really surprised that he had such a keen insight in how law enforcement works and that he was able to manipulate that and really use that. I don't want to give it all away, but then he told us a very, what some people might think is a tall tale of knowing other serial killers who were still out there, still active, working the highways of America and still getting away with murder.
Yeah, that was just incredible to me. Look,
you know, I think we were so shocked by the idea that in this day and age, territorialism between law enforcement agencies was so prevalent that it would prevent murders from being solved. You know, like, and so what we wanted is we wanted to find a long-haul serial killer who would tell us that they used these inadequacies of law enforcement, that they knew they existed, this territorialism existed, and they used it to their advantage. Because we were trying to, you know, we want law enforcement to work together. We want everybody to work together. We want everybody to kind of, you know, create the best databases possible. So if we could speak to a long-haul serial killer who kind of could point out, who could say point blank, yes, I knew, you know, that these guys don't speak to each other, maybe it would help convince everybody to close that loop. And the good news is we are seeing that loop being closed a little bit. We now know that law enforcement agencies are making better attempts to put that territorialism aside, but we need to be even better. We need to really be working together as much as possible. So that was our goal, I think.
It's interesting, too, is that you expand this, as you say, that this investigation is expanded to an examination of the entire phenomena of serial murder and murder in general, especially when it comes to the marginalized, the prostitute that seems to be always the victim of these people. And then you get to do, again, this is so profound, this series, that you even talk to it's very courageous that you interview a motorcycle club member. And if prostitutes already didn't have enough of a tough time in America, then you talk about the border states where it looks like what you found is prostitutes that are used as drug and money running and then disposed like trash in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
So that expansion includes, you talk about Albuquerque. Tell us a little bit about this expansion into even more horrifying murder and that reality that goes along with it.
Yeah, I mean, when it came to New Mexico, we didn't know what we were stumbling into. I mean, that's 11 bodies found in a mass grave. You know, it's interesting. Some people ask, like, what do you feel like you're going to solve any of these cases? I hope that with the show that we do, the New Mexico case, the Albuquerque case, was one of the few that I felt like, guys, what's going on? There's so many different threads to go down there. There's so many people. There's so much speculation. There's all these, like, grumblings of people knowing these women went missing before they went missing. And these are women, unlike the women in Long Island, they were working the street. They had face-to-face with vice cops on a daily basis. People knew them, and the drugs were hard there. I mean, that's one of the places we were, like, hanging out at 3 o'clock in the morning in very sketchy neighborhoods. So speculation with that case is very, very interesting. I think it could definitely be some kind of drug cartel situation there. But again, that is one of the law enforcement agencies that was the toughest for us. They would not talk to us. They are under investigation by the Department of Justice, and they remain to be. And to this day, they have not really corresponded with us at all. It's going to be interesting with that. Well, not much. It is going to be interesting with that case. There is some new information coming out that we will round back to as these episodes air. So there might be some traction there with that case that I'd be interested to see how that evolves.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we do know for sure, drugs, you know, it's like, first of all, no little girl ever wants to grow up to be a sex worker, you know. And, you know, sex work is a lot of times part and parcel with addiction issues. And,
right. You
know, drugs are, there is, number one, a huge opioid epidemic ravishing this country. And we even get into that. And of course, you know, that's what's happening in Chillicothe, Ohio. And as the media, you know, we have, again, a tendency to like, oh, there must be some reason for this. You know, Discovery ID went to Chillicothe, Ohio, thinking it was a serial killer. And then they found out it was, drugs, you know. But, you know, that doesn't fit with the narrative that we want to create here. So, you know, it's sad, and that's also what happened with, you know, in Albuquerque here. You know, I think there's a lot of drugs going on, and I think, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, that's here. But Rach brought up a very interesting thing, and kind of stepping back and looking at it. We worked with some very great law enforcement officials, and the ones who were transparent were great. Mike Chitwood, who at the time was the police chief of Daytona. The guy was extremely transparent. And, you know, I think people felt really safe in Daytona despite what was going on. And, you know, he was very open and he was great. But a lot of the other law enforcement agencies that we looked at, let me just say, out of the 5 cities we looked at, 3 of those cities – their law enforcement agencies were under investigation by the Department of Justice for civil rights violations. So that should be a clue that, you know, unsolved serial killer cases, law enforcement agencies that are under investigation by the Department of Justice, what we're looking at And what Rachel said before is it's not just the killer who commits these murders. Yes, that's the individual. But the killer has to believe that he can get away with it, you know? And I think that that's the problem that we're looking at here. It's just too easy for these guys to get away with it, whether they're long-haul serial killers, whether they're killing African-American women in Cleveland, or whether they're killing, you know, Caucasian sex workers on the internet in Long Island. We just make it too easy for these guys to get away with it.
Now, you talk about Tricia Griffith, and she's the owner of WebSleuths.com, and you do talk about, or basically refer to, the role of again, this cyber community in being able to assist police, again, unofficially, because the police aren't asking, nor are they encouraging any of this assistance whatsoever. But regardless, this is somewhat of a call for... And as you prove in the series, it's very, very effective. So tell us what you would envision the role of web sleuths and documentary filmmakers like yourself and just interested citizens could, not ideally, but in practicality, what can they really do?
No, it's a good question. And listen, we get it. Like law enforcement, like in terms of like having a real case and one that can stand up in the court of law, can you imagine somehow using a web sleuther? Like that would never hold up. Yet at the same time, we all understand that law enforcement is underpaid and overworked. And, you know, the question here is, you know, for example, like we say in Long Island, there are 5 victims who are unidentified in one of the largest serial killer cases in the past decade. That's 5 out of 10 victims. That's so many possible clues here. And so one of the places where we found web sleuthers really great is doing the little work, the little details that law enforcement can't do, finding those unidentified, looking through, you know, court records, public records, anything that can alleviate the burden of law enforcement. And there's an example in New Mexico. A law enforcement agency had an unidentified victim, and they had a partly disintegrated shirt, right? And they gave that shirt to web sleuths. And it was a very, like, specific ask. They said, could you guys help us identify what this picture is that we found on a body? Within 24 hours, the web sleuthers had the picture and where you can buy it and all this other great information. Okay, so that's how you use these crowd sleuthing sites. You give them one specific task, and you put the power of the people in that one little task. So like Rachel was saying earlier, what we want to do is encourage law enforcement to say, okay, everybody, today – or this week or this month, we want to find out who this unidentified victim is in Long Island, Asian male. Here's everything we know about him. Please help us find him. We're going to have one specific officer who is there going to be asking all these, you know, there to answer all your questions, or he's on the internet. Like, that is how you use web sleuths to solve these crimes. Or, again, that tip, you know, what is this picture of? Or, you know, you use them for the little details and not, you know, you would never use them to actually solve a crime, quote unquote. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And in this as well, this fine work that Web Sleuth is doing and this encouragement of this fine work, also, Rachel, you have undertaken a campaign to be able to correct some of the glaring problems with VICAP, haven't you?
Well, I hope that if it's not us, that someone will pick up that torch and move forward with figuring out how we can create a system of accountability and checks and balances. You know, we have one person, one of the ex-sitting director of VICAP, Greg Cooper, who Josh was speaking about earlier, who understands from the inside the issues with VICAP and really does want to see law enforcement agencies having to enter in all their homicide data to make it completely mandatory. And he, along with his organization, he's now a private citizen, called the Cold Case Foundation, is working at doing that. You know, it's hard to make such huge changes, especially on a federal level. So they are working on a state-by-state program. I think it's called the State Compact Agreement. It's kind of the same idea of driver's license. You know, each state has a different driver's license, but supposedly all the databases are linked up. It's kind of that same idea that from because we're a state-driven nation that go from one state to another, each state agrees to sign on, and it will slowly become federally mandated. We'll see if that happens, but hopefully at least people will understand the total fragmentation of these databases, and which I definitely did not know, and will hopefully put some pressure on those in charge and those lawmakers that, who can make those decisions.
I mean, we're hoping. Look, you know, it's not like big data is, you know, big businesses are using this all the time. You know, it's just the tragedy here is that the public sector is behind the private sector. I mean, look, you have an algorithm through Netflix that can tell you exactly what movie you want, but we don't have the same algorithm working a database for connecting crimes. One day that will happen, but there's no reason why that day can't be today. And, you know, it's a shame that, you know, we don't have the same, you know, tech people working in the public sector that we do in the private sector. And, you know, it's a shame that unfortunately a lot of, you know, the financing that could go towards these computer systems, I mean, I get it. Like, if you had an opportunity, you know, would you want to, you know, get an armored personnel carrier, or would you want to get, you know, a better computer system? I kind of understand that, you know, we all – why some people might say an armed personnel carrier. But at the end of the day, if you really want to solve a lot of those crimes, those cold cases, you know, you need the computer system, you know.
That's the reality of it.
Well, in doing your due diligence here and finding out what the reality is in terms of serial murder and who those victims likely are, with that being the vulnerable – drug-addicted prostitute, what we've found is that this glaring void, this hole, that will affect every single citizen in America. So congratulations on bringing that up and to the forefront, because it isn't just the system failing prostitutes, it's failing every citizen in America.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. The crazy thing that we learned is that your idea of the prostitute, that's totally old school. With the internet, prostitution is changing as we know it. The world's oldest profession is changing. And now anybody with a cell phone can take a picture and post it online and meet up at the Holiday Inn. So, you know, we're not talking about girls who necessarily walk the streets anymore. You know, you don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to have a pimp. You know, what we're finding, what we saw on Long Island, especially, this was middle-class women, you know, who needed to pay their rent, who had children to feed. And, you know, there's this idea that because it's the internet, you're posting on Backpage or what have you, that it's somehow safer. But speaking to the professionals out there, we realized and found out that it's much more anonymous. The internet actually creates a new level of anonymity that nobody really understands. And, you know, what we're also finding is that, you know, nowadays the woman who is posting is, you know, it could be your sister, your mother, you know, it again, the world's oldest profession is changing as we know it. And anybody can become that victim.
Absolutely. Tell us again when the premiere of the Killing Season docuseries will begin.
Rachel? Show premieres on Saturday, November 12th, with back-to-back episodes, Long Island episodes 1 and 2, and then for the next 4 weeks. So two episodes every evening starting Saturday, November 12th. We're also wanting to, at the end of every episode, we have a what we call a call to action card where we give the hotline that people can give tips in. But we also want to drive people to websleuth.com, which both Josh and I will be on quite frequently. I actually was on it during our conversation today and posted to WebSleuth to continue that conversation. You know, Josh frequently calls this show America's Most Wanted 2.0. So we want to drive that conversation to WebSleuth and hopefully be able to source some additional clues and, if nothing else, continue to have these conversations happen.
Absolutely. I want to congratulate you both, Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills, for The Killing Season. Again, very powerful, important, and gripping. I have nothing but superlatives for this. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Killing Season.
Thank you so much for the talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.
All right. Good night.